You know, I'm the only candidate that was head of the DEA that was in charge of border security in the Bush administration, governor for 8 years, and the record that I had then, Congress, the last time we balanced the budget.
Asa Hutchinson was really one of the most thoroughly qualified candidates in the 2024 GOP presidential primaries, but was not able to field much media coverage.
Every story is about Donald Trump.
Well, former President Donald Trump is not in Iowa today. He was in a New York courtroom.
That Trump has been in the lead consistently over all this time. He really is the favorite.
With Trump's town hall announcement falling on the same night as the CNN debate.
Either his court case, his criminal cases, the Supreme Court.
Former President Donald Trump is on his way to Miami to be arraigned on federal charges.
Former President Trump is a target of at least three other investigations.
There's just so much happening in his world that you have to say is newsworthy, but it dominates the news cycle. It's hard to get any other message out. So that's the difficulty.
Over many decades of public service, Asa Hutchinson has been a fiscal conservative, and he's also a devout Christian.
I'm a person of faith, and that I have a responsibility to do what I can, but I also know that there's a higher power, a sovereign God that reigns in the affairs of man.
But candidate Hutchinson failed to attract voters in Iowa, where traditionally a large percentage of the caucus goers are both fiscal conservatives and evangelical Christians.
Tonight, former President Donald Trump has been declared the winner in Iowa.
Trump secured a decisive victory in the frigid Iowa caucuses.
Hutchinson has suspended his presidential campaign. He was in Iowa for the caucuses last night.
That is, there's just a deep connection between Donald Trump and the base of our party.
This is The Purple Principle, a podcast on the perils of polarization. I'm Robert Pease, privileged to be speaking with Asa Hutchinson this episode, a discussion that took place at the Principal's first summit in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you like to be called governor?
Well, since it's one of the best titles publicly I've had, I certainly don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
But it's good to be with you today.
Well, thank you, Governor Hutchinson. You're on a panel this morning. It was very well received, but you had a tough primary campaign season, and we wanted to hear about what would you do differently if you were running again, or is that really the best anyone can do in this environment where there's just a very loyal tribal following and not really a situation for a breakthrough?
Well, I could look at the campaign that I just finished running, and I could change four or five things that I did, and none of it would have made a difference. You know, politics is about the moment that you're running, and that is, there's just a deep connection between Donald Trump and the base of our party, and he sold himself effectively.
You declared, I think you were the first candidate to declare other than Trump. Do you feel you got sufficient press coverage as you made that announcement?
No, and I actually, Trump announced, and then Nikki Haley announced, and then I was the third candidate in the race. Nikki Haley and the others, they soft-pedaled any objections to Donald Trump through the first 6 months of their campaigns or more, longer. I started out from day one defining the differences and educating the voters. The media is interesting because, first of all, they give a dominant level of coverage to Trump. But secondly, they cover the polls. And the first pressure was, we've got to get these candidates out to reduce the field. We don't want to have a repeat of 2016 where there's five or six or seven or eight candidates. And then Donald Trump, if he gets 25% of the vote, he can win. All right, well, that argument drove many candidates out. And so it's a constant process story that the media covers that makes it really challenging for candidates to compete.
So you were probably talking with a lot of strategists early in your campaign about, you know, how to position yourself, how to reach voters. What was the best advice that you got from people who understood, you know, the challenge that you faced?
Well, I think it's making the case about trust and knowing the experience. And so whenever you run for president, there's a reason people run twice. And that is it takes one a race for the people of America to really get to know you and to trust you and to understand your record. And you build that relationship with them. And then secondly, you make mistakes the first time that you could avoid the second time. But, you know, what worked for me is making it known what my experience was, that, you know, I'm the only candidate that was head of the DEA that was in charge of border security in the Bush administration, governor for 8 years. And when I'm able to go through that, wow, well, there's nobody that has that level of experience that's running for president. You're ready. But, you know, unless you have tons of money, it's hard to get that message out.
For sure. So speaking of border security, the Senate was very close to a deal. Probable nominee, former President Trump, blew up, at least temporarily, that deal. It does seem like the Democrats have moved quite a bit on border security, and a deal would be possible, which would be, you know, a tremendous thing after 30 years of inaction. So what do you think the prospects are, regardless of who wins, for a true solution to the immigration problem?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right that President Biden moved dramatically to give more tools for border security. One of the big things the Republicans wanted, including myself, is that we needed asylum reform. And President Biden said, no, you're not going to get that. That's too dramatic of a change. Well, he caved on that, and he says, okay, let's do the deal. Let's include asylum reform as well as funding for the infrastructure, for resources, for ICE, for the enforcement, Border Patrol. And notwithstanding, we got what we wanted in that bill. President Trump sent the signal he'd rather have that as a campaign issue. And so the support was lost very quickly in the House. Will it come back? I think there's a chance that it will come back. But to me, when the world is crumbling from Ukraine to Israel, at war to our southern border, Congress goes home for 2 weeks. When the Senate has passed a bill that's ready for them to take action, this is really incomprehensible for Americans. And so they need to get back there, and they need to bring a bill. If you don't like the bill, bring it to the floor. You can amend it, and you can work out the differences with the Senate. But Ukraine is going to crumble to Russia if they do not have the unified support of both Europe and the United States of America. And right now, Europe has sent their check to them. The United States has not.
It is remarkable. And I think, you know, poll after poll shows a majority of Americans do support continued funding for Ukraine, but perhaps not a majority of Republican primary voters in all states. So what were your conversations or your town halls like on that topic?
You know, it's one of those things that people would ask you about your position on Ukraine, and I would give them the answer, we support that. Sometimes they would shake their heads no, but they were all looking at it as that's one issue among many. And also there's others that would say, well, I heard Vivek Ramaswamy's arguments that we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine. What you're saying makes sense. And so they're very persuadable when they're reminded of the history of our engagement and loss of life protecting Europe. Surely we should continue to make sure that Russia doesn't pose a threat to Europe long term.
I do wonder what you're thinking about the possibility of a no-labels bipartisan ticket. We've seen several more traditional conservatives say no to that possibility. Larry Hogan on the Democratic side, Joe Manchin. Do you think, regardless of who no-labels puts on that ticket, that helps Trump? Or is there a possible ticket that might be neutral or might even help Biden?
Well, first of all, if there's ever a year for a third-party candidate to be well-received by the electorate, this would be the year. Secondly, it's an unpredictable year that we don't know what's going to happen with the two major candidates right now. And so there again is a reason for a third party initiative. Now, the argument is that, well, somehow, you know, President Biden is concerned that this is going to take votes away from him. And I think that's totally unpredictable at this point. I think a lot depends upon the candidate that you put forward, the message that they have, and you've got to have a candidate that can pull from both sides, that can pull from the Democrat side, but also pull from Donald Trump's support in order to have a fighting chance to win. So I think there is a potential for a third-party candidacy this year.
So hypothetically, if you were to run third-party, or as you look at the possibility of a no-labels bipartisan ticket, what issues and what sort of ideology would you like to see them espouse?
So the major issues to me would be you've got to tackle the immigration, you've got to tackle your relationship in the world, and you're going to be a trustworthy ally as the United States of America under your leadership. You've got to address the balanced budget, and neither the two political parties are talking about that. That could be the focal point of a message, is doing something about the $33 trillion debt the United States has. So there is some unique place for a third-party candidate with that center-right message.
There's a lot of state-level electoral reform energy because of reforms in Alaska and Maine to open primaries to independent voters. There's 14 states right now that have closed primary elections. There's another 14 or 15 where at least one party has a closed primary. And there's also ranked choice voting for the first time at state levels. We're wondering, you know, as a former attorney and also as a governor, do you think these efforts have a legitimate prospect of changing Congress into a more functional, pragmatic body?
I do. And I was not always a believer in that. I resisted ranked choice and different initiatives that would weaken the two major political parties. And now I don't see it as weakening the parties as much as forcing the candidates to say we've got to appeal to a broad swath of the American electorate. And that, to me, is the benefit from it, that the parties can adjust and operate within whatever election structure you give them, but it will cause the candidates to have a broader appeal. And that, to me, is what is needed. Whenever you look at the redistricting of our congressional seats that now have become islands for Republican or a Democrat candidate, that they're almost guaranteed re-election. They don't have to worry about the general election. They're always worried about a primary contest. And that drifts the Democrats left and it drifts the Republicans right. So I see some of those election reforms as addressing that challenge.
Well, you seem like an optimist, and there's not a lot of room for optimism in our politics. So how do you maintain your optimism? Is it your faith in Constitution and the people you've met on the campaign trail? Because a lot of people are in despair and some people are tuning out and just saying politics is too much for me.
Well, the answer is, first of all, yes, the Constitution, because you worry about who's going to be the next president and whether you can survive, our democracy can survive another 4 years. And the answer is we've got good checks and balances in this country. And you have to have confidence in those checks and balances that doesn't allow our system to get so out of whack that you undermine our democracy. So I am optimistic because of the strength of our Constitution. That doesn't mean you can be apathetic. You have to engage every day and do your part to make sure we go the right direction in our country. But secondly, I'm a person of faith, and that I have a responsibility to do what I can, but I also know that there's a higher power, a sovereign God that reigns in the affairs of man. And so that gives you hope and optimism about the future and a faith that our country, under God's hand, will survive.
Well, let's hope so. And we thank you for speaking out and for running a campaign on principles and on policy. And we wish you best of luck.
Thank you.
Good
to be
so
with
much.
You. Thank you.
Bet. We've been speaking with Asa Hutchinson, a true conservative with a remarkable record of public service as a U.S. attorney, a member of Congress, a governor, and a cabinet official. But that experience did not seem to impress GOP caucusgoers in Iowa, where he failed to win delegates. So he departed the race soon after.
Breaking news literally within the last few seconds, Donald Trump is the winner of the Iowa caucus.
Hutchinson never managed to build significant momentum in the polls.
Hutchinson has suspended his presidential campaign. He was in Iowa for the caucus.
As Governor Hutchinson noted, the Trumpian hold over the GOP base remained unshakable through the 2024 primaries. And many media outlets may unwittingly contribute to that hold by focusing so much coverage on Trump to the exclusion of other candidates and other issues.
We've talked so much about Trump and people are saying—
The Iowa poll shows former President Trump remains the front. Former President Donald Trump is on his way to Miami to be arraigned on federal charges.
We'll hear more on that subject from former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele, now an MSNBC host and commentator.
So I'm still in it to hold up the mirror to my fellow Republicans to look how ugly they've become in their behavior, how un-Lincoln-like they are, how they've turned their back on Reagan, who probably is looking at their dance with Putin and Urban and others going, who are these people?
We sure hope you'll join us for that discussion. And please see our YouTube channel for video of this episode's featured guest, Asa Hutchinson, and of recent guests like Charlie Sykes, as well as upcoming guest Michael Steele and many others. We'd also love to get your feedback and input via our website, purpleprinciple.com, or through social media. This podcast is very much a team effort. Kevin A. Klein, senior audio engineer, Alex Corot, associate producer, Trevor Profit, digital ops and strategy, Sarah Kim, research and fact-checking, Mary Claire Cogler, video production and editing. The Purple Principle is a Fluent Knowledge production. Original music by Ryan Adair Rooney.